In the next 45 minutes, you will hear an examination of two issues that have become one, the death penalty and Carol Chessman. The death penalty is more than an abstract concept. It is death imposed by society. A difficult thing to grasp by the mind, it is intimately felt by those immediately concerned. These sounds are the last a condemned man hears as he enters the execution chamber. First, the slam of a steel door. Then the gurgling of acid and water. Finally, the lowering of the deadly cyanide pellets. This is the voice of a man under sentence of death.
Once more, I'll be faced with the imminent probability of taking a walk into that little green room at San Quentin, being strapped down and put to death. Of course, I'm not anticipating that, and I'm not hoping for it, I don't think. I have no secret desire to leave this world at this time, but at the same time, I'm compelled to recognize what precisely I'm up against.
The voice belongs to Carol Chessman, scheduled to die in the gas chamber at San Quentin on May the 2nd, and center of a worldwide controversy over capital punishment and the nature of American justice. On May the 21st, 1948, Chessman was convicted on 17 charges, including burglary, armed robbery, and kidnapping with intent to do bodily harm. Under California law, kidnapping with intent to do bodily harm is punishable by death. Chessman was convicted on two counts of sexual assault during the commission of an armed robbery. This woman charged Carol Chessman with one of the crimes for which he is scheduled to die.
This car came up the hill, and we noticed the man in it, and he went up and turned around, and as he came back, he flashed a red light, and we thought it was the police. He walked up to the car and he flashed the light, a flashlight in. And he said, a police officer, he said, have you got any identification? And we said, well, we were just looking at the lights. And he said, let me see your identification. So Mr. Lee took his wallet out and showed him his Masonic card and Elks card and all of his identification, driver's license and everything. Then he pulls his handkerchief, which was around his neck, pulls it up over his bottom part of his face, and he said, this is a holdup. He stuck the gun in the window of the car, and he said, the door was open, and he said, I said, get out. So I had to lift my legs out, and as I stood up, I seemed like everything went black. And then he told me not to try any funny stuff. He said to start walking, so he put the gun in my side and walked me back to his car and opened up the car door. And all the time, once I thought of if I fell down, that there was sort of a little bank there and rolled down, I could get away. But then he told me he would kill me, so he put me in the car and then he put the gun in my side. And I begged him not to. And he kept poking the gun in my side. And still I begged him not to make me. And I kept pleading with him not to make me take my clothes off.
California justice demands Carol Chessman's life in payment for that crime. He is scheduled to spend his last moments on Earth in the same fashion as all other men sentenced to suffer the death penalty by the state of California. 42 of the states of the Union inflict death penalty for capital offenses. Although the procedures may vary from state to state, the atmosphere of the ceremonial has a similarity wherever it takes place. A death watch officer in San Quentin.
In the morning, the man wakes up. Nobody wakes him up at any particular time. He wakes up himself. He eats his breakfast if he wants it. Insofar as possible, they honor any request that's reasonable. Most of the requests are. He has his breakfast. He makes his peace with his God, with the chaplain of his choice. As a rule, he sees the warden. The warden tells him that the execution will be carried out. And the actual time is set for the execution, the actual minute, at approximately 10 a.m. in the morning. The officer comes and he unlocks the door. A rug is put down on the floor so that he does not get his feet cold. The man is escorted from the death cell approximately 3, 4, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, approximately 12 steps into the execution chamber itself. As we stand in the execution chamber, we notice that there are two green chairs labeled A and B. As we enter the chamber, chair B is on our left. This is the chair which is adjacent to the windows, which are visible to the witnesses. As a rule, most inmates are executed, are placed in chair B, so as to afford the witnesses a proper view. The chair itself is painted a light green, as is the inside of the chamber itself. It could be called, I guess, octagon in shape. On the chair, it's a canvas webbing type of straps, familiar to most soldiers in World War II. One is placed around the man's upper chest against the back of the chair. As another one goes across the lower chest, another pair of them are placed around his forearms as they rest on the arm of the chair. And two more are placed around each leg, the lower part of the leg, as it would hang over the chair. At that point, after the execution detail has strapped the man in the chair, they withdraw from the chamber and the door is closed.
When a man is executed by the state in the 20th century, he dies scientifically. The most up-to-date methods are used to facilitate his departure. Many, however, question the morality and the efficacy of the death penalty. Some think it a return to barbarism, a symbol of human failure. Listen to the governor of California.
The naked, simple fact is that the death penalty has been a gross failure. Beyond its horror and incivility, it has neither protected the innocent nor deterred the wicked. The recurrent spectacle of publicly sanctioned killing has cheapened human life and dignity without the redeeming grace which comes from justice meted out swiftly, evenly, and humanely. No matter how efficient and fair the death penalty may seem in theory, in actual practice in California as elsewhere, it is primarily inflicted upon the weak and the poor and the ignorant and against racial minorities. In California and in the nation as a whole, the overwhelming majority of those executed are psychotic or near psychotic, alcoholic, mentally defective, or otherwise demonstrably mentally unstable.
Governor Pat Brown's feelings are strong, and yet it is his state on which world attention is focused. It is California where the old question of the death penalty, right or wrong, has become intertwined with the question of Carol Chessman, a symbol to some of the will to live, to others of rampant bestiality. It is our purpose this evening to examine the whys of the Carol Chessman case, some of its larger implications, and the role of capital punishment in 20th century society. What is there about Carol Chessman that has made him the center of an international whirlwind? Some say it is because he has survived against the overwhelming power of the state for 12 years. Others insist that he has not received due process of law. A large segment of opinion points out that Chessman and the issue of the death penalty are made for each other. Chessman, while in prison, has written three bestsellers describing his early life, his trial, and what has happened to him since he entered death row. The convict author and the death penalty issue are, for the moment, inextricably joined. This results in some degree from the many questions his prospective death raises about the quality of our judicial processes and the morality under which the state takes human life. Carol Chessman insists he is innocent of the crimes with which he is charged, but a jury of his peers found him guilty. J. Miller Levy successfully prosecuted the Chessman case and demanded the death penalty.
If you read the record in that case of what he did to those two women, I say he, along with all things considered, as I argued to the jury, the other offenses, and his prior behavior pattern from a juvenile of 16 years, I say he earned for himself the penalty of death.
One of the key elements in the American constitutional structure is the guarantee to every citizen of due process of law. Al Matthews, a Southern California attorney who aided Chessman in his defense, describes the 12-year-old trial.
We were able to get a hold of most of the police reports, a thing that's common now but very difficult at that time. And we used them to show the variance between the descriptions the victims gave to the police at the time that they first reported the offense and the difference between the description of the suspect and the way Chessman looked in court. And it was quite astounding in many instances that there was a substantial difference. Some of them had him with an accent, some of them had him as an Italian, and all the way down the line, there was, I would say, if you had to submit it to a judge, any judge, on the basis of the variance of the two identifications, the one at the time of reporting the offense and the other at the time of the trial, that you'd have to find Chessman not guilty.
Under California law, any defendant under the death penalty has the right of automatic appeal to the federal courts. The basis for his appeal, on which in most cases his life depends, is the transcript of the original trial. Attorney Matthews presents the Chessman view on the validity of his trial's transcript.
You've got a dead reporter in a criminal case involving a man's life, and so the transcript can't be made up. When it is made up, the defendant isn't allowed to be there to check it, to argue in court. Then you discover that it was made up by a man who was a drunkard. When they finally go all the way through with the transcript and check it again after the Supreme Court of the United States told them to do so, what do you find? There are 2,000 errors in that transcript. And still they say it's all right. 2,000 errors. I don't know of any other circumstance where people make 2,000 errors and the thing's laughed off or put down or palmed off. That's too many errors. So, if you don't have a transcript, you can't have an appeal. If you don't have an appeal, you should have a new trial. And that's what it. I don't care if there's enough evidence to convict Chessman. He hasn't had a proper transcript if there are 2,000 errors in it. What's Chessman mean? I don't think the guilt or innocence has ever been the thing that's bothered me in this case. The thing that's bothered me is the violation of due process of law. I'd say that an innocent man, if he were handled in the same way that Chessman was handled, could well have been convicted because of the looseness of the procedure.
Prosecutor Levy answers the charge.
I do not quarrel with his effort to appeal. He, like any other defendant, has the right to appeal. But though he may have had the right to be present when the record was originally settled, as the United States Supreme Court waited until June of 57 to permit, I would have had no quarrel if he was there. The record would have been settled in 1949 with him present. I would like to read from Justice Richard Chambers of the United States Circuit Court, who on February the 8th, 1960, ruled that Chessman had no further appeals. The great hole in Chessman's position is that under the first transcript and the second, or resettled transcript, and under such a transcript as we might have if we accepted all of the rest of his, that is Chessman's, specific, trifling objections to this and that in the record, he cannot get away, cannot shake the simple, vulgar, violent story of what he did.
Abraham Lincoln Wirin is the chief counsel for the Southern California chapter of the American Civil Liberties Union. He has served as attorney for Carol Chessman on many of the convicts' appeals. Wirin presents this view on the Chessman situation as it stands today.
If Chessman is executed now, it certainly will have all the appearance to persons of goodwill toward the United States the world over that really what happened to Chessman was that he was being used as a pawn in a high international game, and that he was snatched from death chamber solely in order to afford protection to our president. Now, of course, our president is entitled to protection and should receive every protection wherever he goes. But it just doesn't seem fair to me, and I think it cannot seem fair to many persons throughout the United States and throughout the world, that any human being, whether he be named Chessman or have any other name, be used as a pawn and to be have his life spared just for a short period solely in the interests of the welfare of the President of the United States.
What has kidnapper Carol Chessman to do with the President of the United States? This is a statement issued by Governor Brown immediately after granting Chessman a 60-day extension on life only hours before he was to die on February the 19th of this year.
I have determined to stay the execution of Carol Chessman for a period of 60 days. I do this because I want to give the people of California an opportunity through the legislature to express themselves once more on capital punishment. During the 60 days, I will put the issue on a special call concurrent with the legislature's budget session. Another serious matter which has influenced my decision for reprieve is embodied in the following telegram, and the text of the telegram is as follows, and I quote, "Through our embassy in Montevideo, the National Council of the Government of Uruguay, the nation's nine-member executive authority, has tonight brought to urgent attention of State Department grave concern of consul over an anticipated hostile demonstration of student elements and others to Chessman execution when our president visits Uruguay March 2nd, signed Roy R. Rubottom, Jr., Assistant Secretary of Inter-American Affairs, the Department of State."
The governor's clemency secretary, Cecil Poole, recalls the incident.
My secretary in the outer office screened through the hundreds of wires that came in and endeavored to bring to my particular attention any that seemed to be important over and above just the usual ones. This wire from Mr. Rubottom was among those which my secretary singled out and placed on my desk. I must say that I almost lost it because there were several hundred other wires on the desk at the time. When I saw its contents, I immediately called the governor and read it to him over the telephone, and he reprieved Chessman pretty close to midnight.
Here is California Attorney General Stanley Mosk.
I felt that, to a certain extent, the State Department showed a lack of courage. It did the right thing originally. But then when it found that the right thing caused some unjust criticism, it attempted to back away. Then when members of Congress became critical of the State Department's action, instead of defending it forthrightly, as I think it should have done, State Department began to run and to equivocate and to suggest that maybe its interest was aroused by inquiry from California originally. This, I think, was both untrue and cowardly, in that if State Department interest and concern in foreign affairs can be stimulated by a cursory call from a public employee in one of the 50 states, then our foreign policy is indeed in shaky hands.
The highest judicial officer in California is angered at the conduct of the United States State Department. Senators express dismay at federal interference in a state matter. The Vice President of the United States puts himself on record in favor of the death penalty. Large numbers of people in South America and Europe begged the governor of California to commute the death sentence of a convicted robber, kidnapper, rapist. Why? For most observers, two factors stand out. The first is Chessman's brilliance. Even more vital is the fact that people throughout the world find it difficult to understand how the American judicial system can permit a man to be kept under sentence of death for 12 years. Since he has been imprisoned, 9 execution dates have been set for Carroll Chessman. He has been within hours of execution 3 times. A dramatic figure in himself, the context of his experience provides the basis for the world's interest. What is Chessman's background? Here is a childhood acquaintance.
Even as a child, I felt sorry for him. His father seemed to be on the harsh side. And Carroll had respect for the teachers in a way, but he seemed to resent if they tried to tell him something. He was just quietly resentful. I know his mother was paralyzed or bedridden, and she couldn't do the things that she would like to have done, I'm sure, for him. He just seemed to give the appearance of being neglected. He was sort of a lost soul when I knew him.
Father Edward Dingberg is the Catholic chaplain on San Quentin's death row. What is Chessman the man?
My relationship with him has been very cordial at all times, and he has been most respectful. Insofar as his development over the years is concerned, as I, as one person, observe it, I feel that there has been a change in him. My earlier contacts, or the earlier years, that is, perhaps he was not so mature in his approach to things emotionally. He has matured in this sense that he now feels that it isn't a question only of Chessman dueling with those who would try to execute Chessman. He has said on more than one occasion that he feels, in addition to whatever he may be able to do for himself personally by way of relief from the death penalty, that perhaps he has also contributed a service socially in bringing light to bear on the death penalty and all the factors and circumstances therewith connected. And I must be honest in saying I think this is true.
The chaplain discusses Chessman's public image.
He has deplored at times the characterization of himself as arrogant and egocentric. Said that this, of course, was a misunderstanding of the vehemence with which he expresses himself and the strength of his convictions, and that he really isn't that. I think, too, here, this is true.
Attorney Wirin discusses both the issue and the man.
Chessman is an unusual person, probably has become completely rehabilitated, and if allowed to live, would be a creative and useful person. I do not think that he ought to be allowed to live solely for that reason, and therefore that others who are not as creative or as skillful should suffer the death penalty. I certainly am of the view there should be no death penalty against anyone, because I think that the intentional and deliberate taking of a human life is never morally justified, and it's least justified when the state itself acts as the executioner. I think those persons who, for instance, take this position, I am opposed to capital punishment, but as far as Carroll Chessman is concerned, I think he ought to be executed. That they are either mistaken or are yielding to the present clamor and pressures in some places against Chessman. I think that kind of a distinction or discrimination negates and undermines the moral base against capital punishment. And that is the true, sound, solid base upon which persons should posit their opposition to capital punishment.
What is the sound, solid basis of opposition to capital punishment in its broadest aspect? Arthur Kessler, journalist, thinker, philosopher, and author, has this to say.
If one has seen violence from close quarters, and you know that during the Spanish Civil War I was in the death cell, capital punishment is no longer an abstraction. By taking the murderer to the gas chamber, or by breaking his neck on the gallows, the victim won't come back to life. You simply add a second cold-blooded ceremonial murder to the first. If capital punishment had a deterrent effect, then perhaps it would be justified. And I say perhaps, because even in that case, the philosophical or metaphysical question would still remain whether any end justifies the deliberate taking of life by the state.
There is an answer to Mr. Kessler's view on the death penalty. Henry G. Rice's 9-year-old son was murdered by a maniacal, sadistic sex criminal.
My contention is that men that don't fit in society have been proven to be unfit to live with their fellow human beings. Should not be made a ward of the state from now on. They're of no use to themselves, to the state, or to the people that have to support them. So I feel that people that deliberately kill little innocent children should not be sitting up in a penitentiary and living off the people that they more or less must hate because they always perform all these things against their fellow man. So why should their fellow man have to support them and take care of them, provide institutions, medical care, and everything else to make life as pleasant as possible for them? This may sound pretty bitter, but if it's your son, you'll know.
Mr. Rice's attitude is applauded by law enforcement personnel. Los Angeles Police Chief W.H. Parker.
It's the police officer who must be on the scene, must arrest these people, must deal with these cases at first blush, that knows more about the behavior and reasons for behavior of these criminal elements. Now, we had these two cases in our city in the last week where two different criminals in entirely different situations were brought into custody in the perpetration of crime. One of these criminals, with a companion, was engaged in a holdup. He got the drop on two of our police officers separately and could have killed either one of them. When asked why he didn't, he said because of the death penalty, and that was the thing that deterred him. His partner was carrying an unloaded gun, and the explanation for that is that he didn't want to get involved in the type of crime that might cause his execution. We believe that there is ample evidence, and at least the policemen believe it, that the removal of the death penalty, both as to the police and prison guards, is almost a license.
One of the country's leading criminologists, statisticians, Dr. Thorsten Saleen of the University of Pennsylvania, now teaching at the University of Cambridge, disagrees with Chief Parker.
It has been claimed quite often by the police that they are better protected in death penalty states than in abolition states. If they are correct, then the death penalty could be demonstrated as having such deterrent value. All the studies that have been made and all the statistical comparisons in this country and abroad indicate that none of these propositions is true.
Our reporter talked with an armed robber who describes his experiences in the state of Michigan, where the death penalty has been abolished, as opposed to his activities in Canada.
Of the number of armed robberies that we committed, I would say that there was approximately 12. Out of the 12, there was 8 of them that I know of, that I can remember, that were committed in Michigan. In Michigan, we never carried an empty chamber in the cartridge. You didn't have to, because you could carry a submachine gun in Michigan and not get any more for killing a guy than if you killed him with a pea shooter. It wouldn't matter. If you killed a man in Michigan, you went to jail. If you killed a man with a shotgun, you went to jail. If you killed him with a machine gun, you still went to jail. In Canada, we went into a store. It was a jewelry store. We went in with unloaded guns, with silver paper stuffed in the chambers to make it look like bullets, because nobody wanted to kill anybody. It wasn't because we were kind-hearted to the fact that we wanted to see him alive. We wanted to see him alive because this is going to keep us alive. As long as he's alive, they can't do much to us but send us to jail. But if we kill him, then they can hang us.
Dr. Austin McCormick of the University of California of Southern California is a noted criminologist. He comments,
the question of guns, toy pistols, and so on, I think this thing has been very badly twisted in some of the testimony that I've heard in various places. These offenders, when they're caught, will tell you almost anything to create the best possible impression, and they want you to think that they wouldn't possibly take a human life. Many of them don't have guns that are loaded or have toy guns because they honestly don't want to take a human life. They're burglars, and they want to steal, and they want to scare somebody so they can steal, but the last thing on earth they want to do is to kill anybody. Furthermore, what they think is not known. Only what they chose to tell the officers arresting them or somebody in the police station questioning them, and later what different thing they chose to tell the prison officials. I don't believe these reveal true motivation.
Clinton P. Duffy, the famous warden of San Quentin, discusses the death penalty in terms of equity.
I do not believe in the death penalty because it is an inequality of justice. There are quite a number of lifers, both murder first degree, murder second degree, and manslaughter. There are other life-term prisoners on kidnapping and habitual criminal act that are serving a lesser degree than the death penalty. They, too, have committed serious crimes but were not sentenced to death. There are cases in San Quentin Prison's yard and in Folsom's yard that I could point out to you that committed crimes as atrocious as those men who are on condemned row, and they were not sentenced to death.
Warden Fred Dixon, Duffy's successor, speaks to the same issue.
The thing that has happened in capital punishment is that the people who were executed were usually poor, insignificant people that no one cared a great deal about, and the majority of them represented minority groups or people without funds. And that is still true to a great extent. We see it in our state. Money has a great advantage.
Does an innocent man ever die by the people's mandate? Warden Duffy has a story to tell.
I'll tell you the story as it happened as I was secretary to the warden back in the early 30s. I was seated in the warden's office this day. I did not go to the execution with him. Another member of the staff did. The telephone rang just a moment before 10 o'clock, the scheduled time for the execution. It was the governor's secretary in Sacramento. He said, "Clint, has the execution gone through yet?" I said, "I don't know. I'll find out." He says, "Stop it. The governor has signed a reprieve. He has new evidence. He wants the execution stopped." I picked up the telephone quickly, got a fast connection to the death house, asked the officer if the execution had gone through, and at that time, before he had time to answer, I heard the trap drop, and the man had been executed. I told the governor's secretary what happened. He said, "Clint, do not mention this to a soul. Do not even tell the warden. The governor had signed a reprieve. He had new evidence, and we will just forget it."
Though Clinton Duffy is still to many the warden of San Quentin, it is doubtful that he ever encountered a more difficult situation than the present San Quentin chief. Carol Chessman has brought problems to death row. The warden discusses the change in his most famous prisoner.
I've seen in the 12, 16 years since I've known Carol Chessman changes of a man that's 16 years older than he was when I first knew him. And this in itself changes people, maturity and age and so forth. As I've seen that happen, all men up there are under terrific strain of facing the death penalty while they remain on condemned row. The unusual part of a man being on condemned row for nearly 12 years, such as Chessman has, is he sees prisoners come, he sees prisoners go. Condemned men come in, are either executed or are commuted or reversed back to the courts for court hearings. Something disposes of them as they go along, and here he stays on year after year, occupying, seeing this thing happen. I think all of this certainly has an effect upon any human being.
Wardens are a small proportion of the prison population. Perhaps no group of men have a more vital interest in society's methods of rehabilitation and punishment than do our convicts. A group of prisoners in the big yard at San Quentin discussed the number one topic, the death penalty.
If I was doing life without possible parole, I wouldn't take nothing off of you, see? Because I know they couldn't gas me, so if you got out of line, I just run a shift through, give me another five life, I can't never get pardoned. So you got to have a death penalty to keep these old things straight.
Well, suppose they killed me. What are they proving? Are they justifying by me killing you?
That ain't the idea. There's going to be guys always come to the penitentiary.
And they always
going
right. to be
And you've
got to
have a death penalty. Because you couldn't put a bunch of animals together like that without ever gassing them. They'd all be sniping each other all the time.
What you're saying is we're all animals, barbarians.
No, we're not barbarians, but there would be a certain amount of us that would be if we had a life to do.
What's the point?
I mean, I don't argue with it all day, but I just wouldn't want to live in a penitentiary where that there's a guy could run around here that couldn't gas, because all he'd have to do if he got sore at you, if he had life without pardon, would be stick a knife in you, and he'd give him another life without pardon, he'd stick another knife in you, he's not going home. No, how could you live with a bunch of guys like that?
Don't come here. Stay out.
That's right, too, but most of us do. Can't help it.
How do Chessman's fellow convicts feel about his situation? One young prisoner sums up what appears to be a majority view.
Well, he's been up there an awful long time now. I think if he can beat it this one, I think they ought to set him free. Because he didn't kill nobody. And as it says in the Bible, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. And the guy, he didn't kill nobody. I think they ought to let him at least on the big yard. Because he's put 12 years up there now. I think that ought to be enough punishment for any one person.
It is this prisoner's reaction, multiplied by hundreds of thousands of those living outside of prison walls, who live in places as far off as South America, Europe, Africa, and Asia, it is this reaction that accounts for much of the furor about the Chessman case. On February 19th, a few hours following the last reprieve he has received to date, Carroll Chessman wrote a 17-page letter to Governor Brown. In that letter, he made mention of the fate of his fellow inmates on death row. Somehow, he said, they had sensed their fate was tied to mine, and mine to a pressing social issue of far greater significance than what might, individually or collectively, happen to any or all of us. Chessman's words do reflect the truth of the matter. The issue is larger than any individual. But whether or not the death penalty is favored as a deterrent to capital crime, the overwhelming majority of public opinion outside the United States has one point of view about the Carroll Chessman case. The intense interest in Chessman's situation is aroused in some degree by the finality of the capital penalty. Foreign reaction to Carroll Chessman's long battle to stave off execution by the state has been responsible for focusing our attention on the larger issues. What has caused the intensity of that reaction? CBS reporter Arthur Rabin traveled abroad to find out.
An hour after I arrived in London, I heard my first comment about the Chessman case. The taxi driver taking me to my hotel, aware that I was an American, turned to me and with uncharacteristic British directness said, "How can you kill this man, Carl Chester, after 16 years?" Originally, the question struck me as having its own macabre humor. But as I traveled through Europe and Scandinavia, that loaded question continued to haunt me. For that question from a London taxi driver contained almost all the elements that I found elsewhere. And if we are trying to determine what the Carroll Chessman case means beyond our borders, this question, charged with its accusation and misinformation, will have to be weighed. What are these elements? Well, the facts of the Chessman case have been blurred by time and distance. There is considerable confusion and ignorance about details of the crimes and the subsequent trial and appeals. It is clear also that the Carroll Chessman most Americans believe is the real one does not exist here. Here is no snarling, defiant hoodlum who has made a mockery of our courts and legal system. To almost all Europeans, Chessman is the sensitive author of three books that have a wide circulation. He is a social critic, and he is a man fighting a desperate and courageous battle against the brutal, vindictive machinery of civil government. Chessman the man and Chessman the symbol have been inextricably linked. Second, the indignation felt about the case is passionate and universal. English taxi drivers and Swedish penologists feel deeply about it. And the overriding issue is neither the crime nor capital punishment. to everyone I spoke to on both sides of the capital punishment issue, the execution of Carol Chessman after 12 years of delay would be the final outrage in an already outrageous case. For Europeans simply do not understand how he can be executed for crimes that are not capital offenses anywhere else in the civilized world. And in countries where murderers who are given lifetime sentences rarely serve more than 12 to 15 years, Carol Chessman would be a free man today. Finally, whether we like it or not, whether justified or not, what happens to Chessman will be regarded by Europeans as the individual responsibility of every American.
Perhaps Sidney Silverman, a member of the British Parliament, best expresses what reporter Rabin has found to be the dominant note in feeling beyond our boundaries.
I'm bound to say that I share the universal horror in this country and indeed throughout the world at your Chessman case. This seems to me to be an unheard of atrocity. And what horrifies me a little is the appreciation that I'm gradually acquiring of the insensitivity of the American public to it and their failure to comprehend exactly what it is that we're getting excited about. How can you, in a civilized community, keep a man under sentence of death half a lifetime? If you execute Chessman in the end, you won't be executing the man who committed Chessman's crimes. He's a different human personality altogether. You might just as well take a man, a passerby off the street, and execute him in order to vindicate the law. You know, when you convicted him, he hadn't had 12 years to mature and to grow, and you allow him under your free system a humanitarian prison existence with access to books and music and companionship and paper and pens and typewriters and television sets. You allow him the full run of American civilization and then have so little confidence in the effect of it that you think the man you were executing 12 years later is exactly the man you convicted in the beginning. I can't imagine that American citizens will really tolerate this.
On May the 2nd, Carol Chessman may die in a gas chamber belonging to the people of California. Whether or not his sentence is commuted, the Chessman case has focused attention on the issue of capital punishment. The governor of California called a session of the state legislature to consider the abolition of the death penalty. Although the bill to end the death penalty never got out of committee, the question is once more raised in the minds and hearts of people throughout the country. Whatever the ultimate decision as to the state's right to take a human life, it is an issue of large dimensions, an issue that must be considered in full awareness of its ultimate importance. Carol Chessman is a symbol of the dramatic quality of that issue. That quality is best expressed, perhaps, by California's Attorney General Stanley Mosk.
The Chessman case points up the issue rather dramatically. It demonstrates, it seems to me, the concern of our entire system of justice for the life of one individual. In a totalitarian country, a man like Chessman would be convicted one day and perhaps executed the next. In this country of ours, he has, by legal means, been able to avoid execution of the judgment imposed upon him for over a decade. While some people believe this indicates a thwarting of justice, I look at it as a tribute to our system of justice in that it demonstrates our concern for an individual.
This is Howard K. Smith. Good night.
The Death Penalty and Carol Chessman, narrated by Howard K. Smith, was written and produced by Don Kellerman. Associate producers Philip Gittleman and Arthur Rabin. This program, a Unit 1 production, has been pre-recorded and edited by the Public Affairs Department of CBS News.